Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Let me expand on some of the things that we've been hitting on this morning, because I've studied for many years and taught on this topic of financing higher education, and I'd like to bring up some important points, some battles we lost, some new issues that we need to address, and some recommendations that we think have already proven effective thanks to the new Obama administration and what Bob did and what Martha Kaner is doing in Washington right now, and Secretary Duncan. And maybe we can revive these. Maybe we can revive these things. But first, let me start, go back in history just a bit. The last real debate in American higher education began about 1963 and ended about 1972. We really haven't had a debate like many of our OECD countries have. And they've moved forward. They've implemented new universities, created new systems. The last major battle we had in higher education at the federal level ended in 1972. And guess what? Public higher education lost that fight. The battle was this. Private higher education saw themselves headed for trouble because they're losing their 50% population of the student base. The American community college system was starting, taking more and more students for affordable higher education experiences. Private higher education hit Washington hard and said, we need a direct student aid system. We don't need institutional aid because the states are going to protect public higher education, and you need to give us a way to get public dollars before we start going out of business. Now, if you go back to the congressional testimonies, it was even stated Stanford, Tulane, University of Chicago said they're headed for financial turmoil and trouble for the decades to come if the federal government doesn't step in. Chancellor Bergeron mentioned about stepping in at the federal level. So what ultimately happened in 1972, we created a Pell Grant system of which the student determines where the student wants to go. The federal government makes no determination, no allocation. So it becomes a very market-based approach to higher education. It also gives the federal government basically Pontius Pilate the idea, no mission differentiation, since the student determines where the money goes. So the federal government said that University of California, Berkeley, Cal State University, Long Beach, the community college, or the University of Chicago had equal value and have equal value to the community, to the nation at large. Well, funny thing happened about 8 years later. States started backing out of their responsibilities. The states were supposed to keep the publics working, and were supposed to keep them affordable, supposed to keep them accessible. So now we've implemented a private model at the higher education level, a model that has been ruled unconstitutional at the K-12 level. And now look at the system that we have in place. We have a system, as the economist stated, that is called the Wild West of higher education. We have universities springing up on every street corner in the country. They don't live and die by the market. They're for-profit institutions. They live and die by federal student aid and Cal Grants. In fact, as I speak, they're trying to get the 90-10 rule changed in Washington. The 90-10 rule basically says, and Bob knows this very well, Phoenix gets 89.8% of its funding from the federal government, student aid. They are only allowed to get 90%. They want 100%. DeVry, Kaplan, Argosy, Excelsior, all these institutions that have sprung up who now serve 12% of the student population, they constitute 30% of all Pell Grant money, and they add up to 43% of all the student loan defaults. So you can see where we started in 1972, letting the free market run higher education and not supporting public institutions that remain committed to public missions. Nor did we follow what we did in 1972, because as a consequence, what the Pell Grant legislation turned around and did to make the publics a little happier with the 72 legislation, they authorized the cost of education allowances. Cost of education allowances would give $2,500 to any institution that actually served a Pell Grant eligible student. Why is this important? This was the public part. This was the part that was supposed to keep our institutions committed to low-income students. This was the part that would create a financial incentive for our institutions to serve low-income students, of which today there are no financial incentives to serve Pell Grant low-income students. What we share with Berkeley, what we share with the UC, the CSUs, that we carry the load. We have the largest number and percentage of Pell Grant students in the country. And the UCs have the largest among their peers. They have twice what their peers have. Chancellor Bergeron mentioned the low-income student population here at 37%. Well, the National Public Research University average has dropped to 19%. The National Private Research University average has dropped to 12%. These are your peers. Now, what we also know, what the Chancellor and I also know, these students cost a lot of money. We know they cost money, whether it's in remedial, extra advising, bringing them back to campus to make sure that their jobs don't pull them away, all the right kind of counseling, the smaller class sizes in certain high-demand areas, all of that costs extra money. And we all agree that these low-income students do cost extra money because in 1965 we passed ESEA, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. ESEA basically says we need to create Title I schools in K-12 education, which means schools that have above a certain free lunch percentage receive special funding from the federal government. And that is going to be reauthorized next year. And that's going to be, you'll hear a lot more about the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act next year. But what that also says, why is it that when a student turns 18 and goes to college that they no longer have socioeconomic issues or problems or differences? Why are they all treated fairly? Why aren't the institutions who remain committed to those populations receiving any assistance? That's what the cost of education allowances, which were authorized but have never been funded up to this point. Now, we also learned something else from ESEA. ESEA taught us that first thing states tried to do to the low-income schools, once they started getting federal money, they took their money out. They supplanted the federal money, state money, with federal money. We have many states in higher education doing the exact same thing, supplanting federal money for state commitments. And you saw this chart that Bill put up. This chart says it all. Since 1980, states have backed out of their higher education responsibilities. We spend 40% less in tax effort in higher education today than we did in 1980. California spends 48% less. California is the 12th worst in declining support, and it's rapidly declining support. And I go around the state calling California one of the terrible 12 or dirty dozen that doesn't want to admit this. But what has happened also with ESEA, what we've learned, is that the federal government had to step in and provide maintenance of effort provisions. One reason states can't back their money out of the poor schools, K-12 schools, is the federal government will withhold their federal money. Medicaid operates in the same way as a matching fund. Higher education has never had those protections. They never had those protections, and this may be the most important policy issue to hit higher education, in my perspective, in the last 3 years. Thanks to the work of Bob and the Department of Education and the work of a number of legislators, two and a half years ago, with the passage of the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, for the first time in history, we got language written in that bill that says if you pull your state money out, you have to give this money back, the federal money back. Now, it was in a small program. It was in a very small program, and it didn't amount. It was only $66 million. But it was the first time we got federal language extended, which held states more accountable for funding, not removing themselves from their own statewide commitments. 6 months later, the same language we got transferred into the federal stimulus packages. Now, those federal stimulus packages, you don't hear a lot about it. You hear a lot of griping about it because of the turnover in Washington. Let me share with you from my perspective what they meant to us. Those federal stimulus packages, 2 years ago, we took a $48 million cut in my campus alone. We went from being 40% reliant on California to 28% overnight. That federal stimulus package protected us with half of those funds so we could manage our way through the next 2 years. Not only did it do that, but even more importantly, it was the language written behind the federal dollars. And we had 48 governors battle us to keep this language from showing up in any of those bills. That language said this: you can get education federal stimulus dollars and use them if and only if you do not cut your higher education system below the 2006 year level. Well, NGA, the governors, went nuts. Lamar Alexander said he'd let this pass over his dead body. Well, it passed by one vote in conference that summer. And that language rolled into the stimulus dollars. And guess what happened the very next year? It didn't matter what we did in our state legislatures. It didn't matter who we talked to in Sacramento. Sacramento and 20 other states cut their higher education budgets to the very level of where the federal penalty kicks in. So last year, we were already at that level with the other stimulus package. We were protected. Last year, they weren't going to cut us. One reason higher education didn't get cut last year wasn't necessarily that the governor was so in favor of it, but because we had many Democrats that wanted us equally cut. They couldn't cut us without giving back $700 million in federal stimulus dollars. California 2 years ago cut its higher education budget to within $3 million of a $9 billion higher education budget. Oregon cut its higher education budget 2 years ago within a dollar of where the federal penalty kicks in. Tennessee, Lamar Alexander State, first thing they did is cut their budget to within $13 of their 2006 level without crossing that threshold. Nevada, within $6. So this had protected us basically for 2 years. So it wasn't just the money that kept 21,000 classes that we could offer for our students throughout the system, but it's the language of the federal protections that kept us from where we are. So now the turnover occurs in Washington. Bob leaves, place goes to hell in a handbasket. the turnover hits November, so we know there's no stimulus dollars coming, a third package coming this year. What that tells me is that we're wide open target because we have no more leverage at the federal level. So the first thing we see is the governor's budget that cuts us not to a 2006 level, but cuts us to the 1999 level. The only difference is we're getting the same funds that we got 12 years ago. The difference is we have 70,000 more students now than we did then. And we have twice as many first-generation Pell Grant eligible students as you do. So that's kind of how we got here. Now, I know this is a big issue here in Berkeley, but one thing I've also followed is that as we bailed out the private sector in higher education, follow the expenditure trends as states started cutting our budgets. Follow the expenditure. I've heard Chancellor Bergeneau's recommendations to Washington, and the primary recommendation from the Land Grant Association is this, that the federal government needs to step in and fund a handful of 40 or 50 universities for this reason, because they can't keep up with the expenditure patterns of their private peers. They're losing faculty to these institutions. You've heard this. In 1980, there was no difference in expenditure patterns. The salaries were quite the same. Now Berkeley can't even compete with the salary Stanford's paying, and you probably don't know, but Notre Dame and Rice and Emory are probably paying more than you now, too. And follow their expenditures. This university spends half per student that average research private spends now. And just 20, 25 years ago, those numbers were equal. So just like the federal government stepped in and has created a very lucrative environment for private higher education. In fact, it's become so lucrative that the secretary can't reel them back in. Their power in Washington with their lobbyists, they can't reel in the for-profit sector, who's making a mockery, quite frankly, of this entire aid system. We must figure a way to create a system of funding that rewards institutions for remaining committed to their public purposes and public missions. Right now, there are no rewards. In fact, the more low-income students you enroll, the worse you look in U.S. News World Report. Because you're less selective, they don't graduate as high, and they don't bring in a lot of resources. So you go down in the rankings. And in fact, as the chancellor pointed out, you have more students than the entire Ivy League combined, low-income population. There are 6,800 Pell Grant-eligible students in the Ivy League. I have 12,000 just on my campus alone. At Cal State Northridge, they have 15,000. And you're always reading in the New York Times or the USA Today about how much aid and how much effort they're putting into their aid. Well, you can put a lot of effort into the aid when you have 600 low-income students, and that's about it. In fact, this system, which was premised on the idea that UCLA, that Stanford, if allowed to play, our private sector institutions like the University of Chicago would become more like the University of Illinois by letting them get into the public trough and funding systems. What has happened is University of Chicago is just as University of Chicago as it's ever been. Their low-income numbers are lower than they've ever been. The difference is the University of Illinois is becoming like the University of Chicago. My institution that I took great pride in, University of Wisconsin-Madison, is down to 8% Pell Grant eligible population. An institution that used to pride itself on its egalitarian service to the state and its low-income populations. So let me make a few recommendations that I think, first of all, what Dennis said about putting all the money on the table is exactly right. We can no longer allow, and the argument we made clear that we finally won, and I have to give credit to Representative George Miller, credit to Representative John Tierney from Boston, Massachusetts. Even we got Senator Kennedy before he got sick on board with this. Senator Harkin from Iowa. The fact is, it doesn't matter how much aid goes into the system. You can increase a Pell Grant. You can double the Pell Grant tomorrow. If the states back their money out of the higher education institutions those students are going to, and tuition shoots up just as much, you have negated the increase in Pell. The financial aid won't matter if states remove themselves from this funding responsibility. And that's what we were able to finally get convinced. And we had two critical chairs and two critical people who took this issue to heart, and it was John Tierney and George Miller. And their staffers know this. The staffers know the value of MOE. They know the value of not supplanting, using student aid dollars to offset state appropriation reductions. And this was made clear to me many years ago when I was standing in the parking lot at the University of Louisville, when the Speaker of the State Senate in Kentucky came to me, who I've known very long time, very powerful individual. He said, I'm going to get reelected, but I'm going to have to cut your budget first. I'm not going to raise taxes, but I'm going to allow you to raise tuition, and then you can go get it from federal programs. But many legislators would rather get reelected than make the right decisions. And in fact, what I learned was that the power of Washington to hold states accountable, like they have in Title I schools, like they have in Medicaid, may be the most important answer that we have. You see, now states, which are supposed to be the main supplier of revenues to American higher education, they're down to $79 billion. That's down from about $90 billion. Federal revenues through all programs, including tuition tax credits, which equate to $14 billion additional expenditures, that amount to $150 billion. The federal government revenues for higher education double what the states are doing now. So my first recommendation is to take the lessons that we've learned from Medicaid, Title I, ESCA, but take the lessons that we also learned from the stimulus in this maintenance of effort provision. Any dollar going to higher education out of Washington ought to be attached to maintenance of effort provisions. To limit our state legislatures, you've seen this trend. I don't have faith in our legislatures, but I do have faith in them wanting federal money. And as they proved, that money can make the decision, not me lobbying, not how many students we have. That money turned out to be more powerful, and those provisions more powerful than anything we said in Sacramento and the Capitol. So number one, make sure MOE is on everything, maintenance of effort provisions on all new dollars. We got $150 billion going into higher education. The more is attached to state behavior, the less likely states are going to remove themselves from their funding responsibilities. Number two, fund the cost of education allowances. Actually create incentives to serve low-income students. The postcode ranking system in England is a funding model that is in the Ministry of Education, out of the Ministry of Education. They rank 112 universities in England from 1 to 112, and they put funding into that system. Now, that ranking is based on how many students are you serving from the 48 neediest communities in England. Guess who finishes last every year? Oxford and Cambridge. So they get the least amount of support, and London Metropolitan University gets a significant amount of support through that program. Without incentives to help us educate and graduate these students, these trends of moving away from low-income populations are going to continue. Sort of the elitist nature, the rankings will still go up. The less you serve, the better you look, the more you'll rank. And the move to out-of-state students, that certainly is going to be a controversial move here in California. But quite frankly, A, we're not getting rewarded for serving in-state students, but rest of the country has already moved to them, not because they want the value of somebody from Michigan on their campus, but because they bring in more money. Michigan's up to 40% out-of-state student population. The University of Virginia is jokingly known in Richmond as the University of New Jersey at Charlottesville. And each step, each percentage that we go in this direction, Tom Mortensen in Okaloosa, Iowa, in post-secondary education opportunity, has clearly shown the students who get left out are the ones who are most academically challenged, be the Pell Grant students. That has gone on around the country. So we must fund what was authorized in 1972. I could do a lot of helping a lot more students if we had those cost of education allowances following the Pell Grant students. Fine. Then my other two, this is a little more radical, but if we're not going to fund the cost of education allowances, and I think I mentioned it to Bob when I was in Washington a while ago, why don't we just set a threshold like Title I has done to receive Pell Grants? Why don't we set a threshold to say every institution that receives Pell Grants needs 20% low-income population? You'll see institutions spin on a dime to get interested in low-income students again. And in fact, when you look at all the Pell Grant numbers, what you're going to find is that the institutions who have less than 20% in this nation are the richest institutions, both public and private, in the country, and they're the institutions that spend the most on their students. Yet they're down to 8% Pell Grant eligibility, with no incentive to get to 20%. And you could even tie it to a tie the threshold to say you could, or you can demonstrate that you're making progress towards 20% to get this aid. That would make a lot of institutions spin and make a lot of institutions become more interested in serving low-income students and tie a percentage of that to graduating those students. Right now, there are no incentives to this commitment. Finally, I think the gentleman from Ireland mentioned our accreditation system. We get our official accreditation next week. I have to fly back up here for an hour so they can tell us that you're accredited. And we have to stand there in person. We have let this get completely out of hand. We've got 30 accrediting bodies that have accredited everybody. And the only reason that they have any power is because they control the $150 billion coming out of Washington. Why don't we do what many OECD countries have done, control this better in the Ministry of Education or in the Department of Education? Don't give it out to private accrediting bodies who have conflicts of interest written all over them. And right now, we've given out so much of this money that we can't even reel it in. And this might even defeat Martha Kander and the Secretary of Education, just because the lobbying power and the millions and millions that have gone in to the coffers of congressional representatives who sent letter after letter to Bob and others to stay off their backs. Now, finally, perhaps the most egregious example of what I'm talking about in sort of the market-based model is what we've done with the GI Bill. As I mentioned, we have 500 veterans on our campus. My veterans are supported. The new GI Bill gives them $4,600. That's what I charge. The new GI Bill gives Berkeley about $13,000. The new GI Bill gives Excelsior, Argosy, Phoenix as much as $30,000 to $35,000 to educate a veteran. And think of the accountability requirements that come with that for us versus what goes out to them. Now, this will be in 60 minutes because I know we have a university that sprung up just down the street from us. That's in it. Circuit City went out of business, a university went in. And they do nothing but serve veterans. I have students who work there who come back and tell me what they're doing. They maximize the GI Bill money, not only the cap, the state cap, but then they maximize what's called a yellow ribbon program. The yellow ribbon program does this. If you can tell the federal government or the Department of Defense how much institutional aid you're willing to give a veteran, they'll match the remainder. ITT Institute immediately said, well, we'll match them. We'll give institutional aid of $99,999 per veteran because the cap was at $100,000. You know, to them, institutional aid is a shell game. It's a shell game. So that's just perhaps the worst example of where we've gone. But we must step in to save public higher education and to make sure that public dollars are being used by public institutions. Our Cal Grant program that everybody loves so much has major flaws. The Cal Grant A program, you probably know, but if you have a 2.9 and you're a low-income student, you don't qualify for it. It's in some ways like a Georgia Hope Scholarship because it's merit-based. So it's got a huge merit component. Many low-income students don't even qualify for it. But two, it was started not as a funding structure that was supposed to, it was started with this purpose in mind, that it wanted to protect this idea of choice that the federal government has done. This idea of choice now gives Pepperdine a Cal Grant A award of almost $12,000. My student gets the $4,600 award. It gives institutions incentives, cost-related incentives, to inflate your prices and look higher, more expensive than you are. So we need to make sure the Cal Grant program looks more like a Pell Grant and doesn't weigh the cost of education as being a main variable in the system. But right now, the awards are drastically different. The same child from the same family will get a $12,000 to $13,000 award to go to Pepperdine, and then we'll have to figure out how to educate him on $4,600. And that's during the year. So keep these things in mind as you're thinking about the future of higher education. We've got to make sure that we can take advantage of $150 billion coming out of Washington, because our states are going to kick us around. And overall, this overall trend over the last 30 years is going to continue. And if you saw the report, this national survey that was in the New York Times about 2 weeks ago that said that the American public prefers that we reduce our spending and not increase taxes. But then did you see the end part of that headline? However, don't touch Medicare and don't touch Social Security. That's the aging of America. And growing up in the state of Florida, we saw it happen, hit Florida faster than anywhere. When everybody moved to Florida, and they came from liberal states too, but once they hit the Florida line, they have stopped supporting education, stopped supporting children, stopped supporting students. And this is perhaps one of the biggest challenges we face. So what I believe we must do is tie the federal funds, just like we have in Title I for schools, reward Title I higher education institutions that are committed, and also we need to make sure that we attach these MOE provisions to each and every one of those dollars. And I think we need new strategies, and those are some of the ideas, and I just want to thank Bob for actually taking on a big issue. When you have 48 governors all against putting this type of language in these bills, and the Department of Education was in favor of it, and we had two champions on the Hill who spirited it through, and within a year, it clearly showed its value to public higher education. We were protected last year. We were protected last year because of that language, not because of what we said in Sacramento or any commitments to our students or any commitments to students on the way. So we're in this with you guys. We're in this for public higher education. We've bailed out private higher education. Look at the expenditures. Look at the per student expenditures. In fact, it costs you guys about $95,000 to produce a graduate. One graduate. That includes your dropouts, everybody. It costs this university about $95,000. It costs Caltech $465,000. It costs Stanford $305,000. So we need to make sure people are putting dollars where it matters, where we can get the most graduates. And we need to make sure, are our governors and is the federal government truly committed to producing more graduates and rethinking state funding formulas and rethinking our distribution of our public funds? So thank you all, and I look forward to your questions.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.